Architects, designers, and planners dedicated to distinctive projects for community, life sciences, and workplace clients. On the web at www.ratioarchitects.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, we peer into Western history prior to the Industrial Revolution, a time when the night was illuminated by fire and the moon. Our guest is historian Roger Ekirch. He is the author of At Day's Close, Night in Times Past. The book delves into the delights and perils of the night, the rituals of the night, and how night was lived by rich and poor in Europe and early America from roughly the 16th century to the mid-18th century. Ekirch says, by the mid-18th century, the foundation was laid for our 24/7 society. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. Here are the numbers. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Roger Ekirch is a professor of history at Virginia Tech, a former Guggenheim Fellow. He is an award-winning author of books and articles. His latest book, At Day's Close, Night in Times Past, is published by W.W. Norton. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Ekirch, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And you?
Just fine. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What led you to research and write a history of night and the advent of the Industrial Revolution?
Well, I really can't claim the credit for that insofar as it is owed a close friend of mine in graduate school, a remarkable individual, 25 years ago, we had talked about collaborating on this topic. He was going to cover the European end, I the British Isles and early America. Unfortunately, other responsibilities prevented his participation, and he has gone on to do other things. I don't claim any sort of mystical bond with darkness, other than walking my dog at night. It has no tremendous emotional or sentimental value for me, but I did think quite early on that it was a potentially tremendous topic, very rich, and for me at least, it has proven unfailingly interesting.
Yeah. Well, I have pages and pages of notes. I really enjoyed it. Where did you turn for source material? There's so the history of the night, there's so many wonderful sources out there.
As you would imagine, for such a ubiquitous subject, the source material is tremendously broad, practically everywhere, in very few locations has there been a particularly dense concentration. I've relied heavily upon personal documents, most of all diaries, but then also letters, memoirs, court records, especially for recapturing or trying to recapture as best as we ever can the voices of the lower classes who, for the most part, were not literate in that day and age. for traditional beliefs. I've also looked extensively at proverbs, glossaries, 17th and 18th century dictionaries, high literature, novels, plays, poetry, but then also, for want of a better term, low literature, such as ballads and fables. And I've tried at least to make extensive use of art from the period.
Mm-hmm.
The book is has 60 black and white illustrations, and I was able to convince my publisher to include some illustrations in color as well.
Yeah, the color plates are very nice. One of the many things I found fascinating, the words used to talk about night. Irish Gaelic, you say, has four terms to chart, in your words, successive intervals of time from late afternoon to nightfall. Would you share some of the ways in which people describe the coming of night in the pre-industrial age?
Oh, there were a variety from those more familiar to us, such as dusk or evening, to the daylight gate. The most common, which crops up over and over again, at least in the English-speaking world on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, was shutting in. Shutting in, which on one level, metaphorically, I think, referred to the shutting in of daylight, but it also had a much more practical significance. Oftentimes, when people use that term synonymously with nightfall, it emphasized the importance of shutting doors, bolting shutters, and remaining inside, despite the fact that oftentimes people would then go abroad, as they put it. But at least ideally, it was thought the safest course to remain within one's home.
Yeah. If you were caught unaware of the coming of nightfall, you could find yourself unable to reach your home.
Mm.
And, you know, speaking of a time when people did not have personal clocks here,
right?
How were people kept apprised of the coming of darkness?
Oh, there were any number of natural indicators that certainly to those of us in urban areas and the suburbs today have long been lost. The different shading of the sun, the shutting of petals of the marigold and other flowers. One of the most interesting is that the eyes, the pupils, I should say, of sheep and goats, as the day progresses and nightfall nears, become much more oval in shape. I thought maybe this was apocryphal, but sure enough, I found in diaries references made by shepherds to this phenomenon. People were very attuned to passage of the day and the coming of night in ways that we have a hard time appreciating today.
Yeah. Well, there were bells.
There were bells, but they did not ring methodically, especially in rural areas.
Hmm. And hymns or prayers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the Angelus, and in the evening, apparently, the Ave Maria was sung.
Yes, which were routinely said in Catholic lands at dusk. In cities and large towns, there was a proverb to the effect that when the Ave Maria you hear, be sure that your house is close.
Mm. And towns, villages, cities, some of these places would literally, the whole community would shut in. There were fortified communities. How common were they, and what were your choices if you were locked out?
That's a very good question. Throughout Western Europe, far less often in early America, there were fortified towns and certainly cities. Especially in continental Europe, there were fewer in the British Isles, where the risks of foreign invasion ultimately subsided. But so too in times of peace as in war throughout Western Europe, where fortified communities, and by that I mean large towns and cities that were surrounded by massive walls, so too in peace as well as war would gates be shut at nightfall. So it wasn't simply a military threat that was feared. Guards would be posted. In some locations, it was a extremely serious offense to even approach a fortified city at night, much less try to scale the walls. There were some, such as the German city of Augsburg, that had a very complex system of tolls and gates that one could pass through after the curfew bell upon payment of a small sum of money. But Augsburg was, as best as I could find out, more the exception than the rule. What would you do if locked out?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you would hope to find refuge in a surrounding suburb, if one existed, or you would be forced to remain abroad, which was a choice of desperation. There were travelers during this period of history who chose to spend the night in leper houses rather than in an open field. People literally believed that night fell, that darkness was not just a consequence of astronomical phenomena, but instead a consequence of dark, vaporous air descending from the heavens, which was extremely perilous to one's health. That was just one of many reasons why remaining abroad overnight was a last-ditch option.
Yeah, and there were demons about, human and supernatural.
Yes. Rarely did pre-industrial folk pause to ponder the beauty of sunset. Threats to body and soul expanded and intensified after dark. I suggest in my book, probably never before in Western history, at least since the birth of Christ, had evening appeared more menacing. Shakespeare, in a passage in The Rape of Lucretia, writes, "O comfort-killing night, image of hell, dim register, notary of shame, black stage for tragedies and murders fell, vast, sin-concealing chaos." Night beckoned a host of demons and spirits, at least according to popular lore, including not only the Prince of Darkness himself, but malevolent fairies, boggles, which was a term for ghosts, werewolves, and most threatening of all, enlisted as the devil's agents, witches.
Hmm. This morning, when it was safe, I Googled things that go bump in the night.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And Google found more than 1 million results. You know, who among us hasn't experienced some kind of fright at night?
Yes.
What would you like to say about what appears to be an ancient anxiety?
Well, the honest answer is that anthropologists and psychologists and certainly not I, can say with ironclad authority when human beings first developed an instinctive fear of darkness. It may literally have been, pardon the pun, overnight, or there's a good case to be made that it arose over a series of generations, and that it was not just darkness itself that terrified our earliest ancestors, but instead increasingly evils such as crime, predatory animals, associated with darkness. Whatever the exact chain of causation there was, clearly by the ancient world, by Mesopotamia, by ancient Greece, ancient Rome, people associated nighttime with a number of evil demons. Even so, and of course, the one of the most famous works of old English literature in the early Middle Ages, Beowulf, transpires almost entirely at night. The monster himself is a creature of the darkness. Having said that, however, Europeans, their fears of nighttime, supernatural demons in particular, would begin to intensify even more in the late Middle Ages and then throughout what historians typically refer to as the early modern period from roughly 1500 until the middle of the 18th century. This was, after all, the height of the European witch craze, when literally thousands of individuals were put to death because they were suspected of practicing black magic and enlisted by Satan, who himself only began to acquire a more menacing persona in the late Middle Ages.
So what did the authorities, in particular church authorities, who I guess were the authorities, have to say about how to conduct oneself at night?
Stay home. In the eyes of church and state, night was meant for rest and prayer. Church and civic officials resorted to a variety of repressive measures, from curfews to watchmen, hoping to curb nocturnal activity. As far as they were concerned, the fewer persons abroad, the better. Night was a no man's land, or so at least they prayed. Toward that end, not only, as I've said, did they close town gates, but there were, at least at first, stringent curfews. Streets themselves were shut off with massive iron chains. The city of Nuremberg in Germany maintained as many as 300 sets of chains. And what limited street lighting there was put out by private households. It was not, strictly speaking, public lighting. And it was chiefly designed to aid pedestrians on their way home, as well as to aid patrols of the urban night watches as they conducted their rounds.
Who were the watchmen? Who kept watch, and what were their responsibilities?
Their responsibilities, first of all, was to sound a warning should any glimpse of fire be detected, which arguably, despite the fears of crime and evil demons, it was arguably fire most of all that terrified individuals the most. The only other group of people that were entrusted with this same responsibility to warn fellow townspeople of fire were prostitutes, in those cities where prostitution was legal at the time. Otherwise, the night watch was meant to get people off the streets, especially anyone who, as a so-called night walker, might have a sinister purpose for being up and about. In terms of their social status, they generally came from the lower orders, from the so-called dregs of society, as contemporaries put it at the time. They had a significant burden of responsibility. That has to be said. I mean, they were really the only government agency of any sort that was abroad at night. On the other hand, contemporary complaints were numerous, to say the least. In the city of Geneva, to prove that they had conducted their rounds regularly, they had to throw chestnuts into baskets lining the streets to satisfy their superiors. Frequently, it was charged that they fell asleep, that they were in cahoots with prostitutes and armed robbers, and that they spent the bulk of an evening in a local alehouse. I think the truth lies somewhere in between.
Yeah. And our term flatfoot goes back to...
Yes, at least for the French.
For the
that
French.
That was a common... The French equivalent in translation was a common term of abuse directed against members of the Night Watch.
Hmm. Historian Roger Ekirch is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about night in the pre-industrial age in Europe, the British Isles, and in early America. Our guest is the author of At Day's Close, Night in Times Past. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. One of the proverbs you include in the book is an Italian proverb, "In the night, every cat is a leopard." And, you know, this says, you know, the imagination grows with the setting of the sun. And this then, you know, thinking about that and then coming across your work, your writing about this period of time, and it was in early modern times, you say, youthful fears in parents' eyes often served a purpose. Rather than soothe children's anxieties, adults routinely reinforced them.
Yes.
Through tales of the supernatural. So now we have adults raised on such tales, the children learning them. Did anyone get any sleep?
Sleep itself, of course, was thought to be an extremely vulnerable state, especially to the devil, so that it didn't necessarily offer one much safety. I think you've hit upon what I think is a very interesting paradox, and that is that, yes, night was a time of great danger, and yet it was surprisingly vibrant. A heck of a lot went on after dark. How does one explain that? Well, I think in two ways. First of all, the answer lies in the appeal that nighttime held for large numbers of people. And secondly, the rituals, techniques, conventions that individuals relied upon to get through the night, but not just that, to navigate the darkness in relative safety. There's a quotation which I think very nicely expresses this paradox. It's from an English poet named William Drummond, who wrote in the year 1616, "I curse the night, yet doth from day me hide."
Mm-hmm.
Light, for people of this age, when there was so little privacy during the day, light was not an unalloyed blessing, nor was darkness invariably a source of misery. Aside from the natural mask that darkness afforded individuals, there was less danger of public exposure owing to the smaller number of pedestrians out and about. Personal associations were by choice at night, peers, equals,
mm-hmm.
rather than one's masters and superiors. Night frequently declared a truce, at least, from daily toil. And, at least for some individuals, the immensity of night itself, I argue in the book, conferred a pronounced sense of personal autonomy. Night knew no bounds, so that an English laborer treading home from an evening's merriment exclaimed to his comrade, "What I had but as many fat bullocks as there are stars." It could be a very empowering time of the day, so long as you were not overwhelmed by your fears, and so long as you took the steps necessary to counter the dangers that night posed.
Mm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's call and talk with this
wonderful
caller on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. A question about the contrast between day and night. Before the Industrial Revolution, there's so much ambient light now that I think we've lost the vividness of that contrast. You read about torchlight parades, for example, even in the 19th century, as being very dramatic events. And we've lost the sense, I think, of how vivid the night sky was to many people then, and the amount of philosophical and religious speculation that it led to. It was a much more dramatic thing to people 200 years ago than it is today.
Yes, I agree with you entirely. Today, of course, we practically inhabit a nonstop culture characterized most obviously by widespread electric lighting, both within and outside homes and businesses. Never before have we been so dependent upon artificial illumination, which arguably is one of our greatest symbols of modern progress. Any number of cities these days tout themselves as 24/7 cities, hoping to attract tourists. It's not to say that all of this is necessarily regrettable, but I think we stand to lose a lot if this present directory of technological progress proceeds without any thought or care. As you correctly say, I mean, only in remote spots can one still glimpse the grandeur of the night sky, including the Milky Way. Entire constellations have disappeared from sight. I was amused, but also a bit concerned. I remember over 10 years ago when I read newspaper reports that the Russian government was attempting to launch an experimental space mirror designed to transform night into twilight in selected locations with the aid of reflected light from the sun. It was a failure, but Canadians in particular, judging from the amount of play that it was given in their newspapers, were particularly upset because apparently they stood to receive, given their latitude, some of this reflected light had it been a success.
Thanks. I'll hang up.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, this point comes home in your book at the close of your book, nicely enough, where you have a photograph from space of Europe at night, and you can see all the lights.
Yes, that's a marvelous image. Of course, there exists a much larger image of the entire world showing still, to be sure, sizable pockets of darkness, especially in the undeveloped world, but in Western Europe and large portions of Asia, and of course the Western Hemisphere, the world is increasingly aglow at night. Consider the fact that were such a picture, could it have been taken 300 years ago, of course it would have been completely black.
Yeah. I remember it was either late last summer or early last fall, in the New Yorker magazine there was an article on North Korea. And as an illustration of the difference between North and South, they had a picture from space of the peninsula at night.
Interesting that you pick up on that, because I sometimes have mentioned that to friends, that if you want to understand the difference between North and South Korea, look at that image.
It was so dramatic.
Black, the other looks like a Christmas tree.
Yeah. Historian Roger Ekirch, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to join us with a question or comment, you're invited. We look forward to hearing from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, today we have people who are experts in sleep and sleep disorders. In this period of time that you cover in At Day's Close, was advice given about how to prepare for sleep?
Yes, quite extensive advice. Oddly, sleep was a topic at the outset of researching this book that I absolutely dreaded having to address with good reason. I thought past historians had proven indifferent at best to human slumber. I mean, after all, a state that lacks the drama and intensity of our waking hours. But I did end up devoting in the book three chapters to sleep. I never would have expected it. I soon recognized, to answer your question, that pre-industrial households went to enormous lengths to ensure both the tranquility and the safety of their slumber. They invested heavily in bedding. One's bed was the most valuable piece of furniture, typically, in a household. In lower-class households, it could represent up to 40% of a family's physical assets. Beyond that, as bedtime drew near, people, of course, double-checked their shutters and doors. They banked their hearth. Some even said charms to put their fires to sleep. They warmed their beds, if not with containers of hot cinders and ashes, then by wrapping a towel around a hot brick. I don't recommend it, by the way. And they regularly said prayers, which were specifically suited for going to bed. Some of these spoke rather formulaically of the dangers of darkness, but then there were others that spoke very vividly about the dangers that to which one was exposed, especially when succumbing to sleep. Many also, I should say, I never would have expected to find this, drank wine or beer just before entering their bed, what in Germany was called a sleeping drink, to spur their slumber, but also warm the flesh on cold nights.
Yeah. Well, in this period, you know, beer, ale, wine were consumed widely.
Very
all
much so.
All day long.
Yes, all day long, and by children as well as adults.
So did this calm anxieties or accentuate them, or both?
In the short term, the hope, and I guess it was fairly realistic, it did calm one's anxieties. On the other hand, as a soporific, as something to induce sleep, it was the worst thing that one could do, or at least close to it, because it ultimately would make your sleep very, very restless and disturbed. Interestingly, at nighttime, especially around 10 p.m. to midnight and shortly thereafter, one is much more likely from drinking alcohol to become intoxicated, given the circadian rhythms within the body. The body metabolizes alcohol less rapidly late at night and in the early morning hours. So you could become intoxicated more quickly by drinking less than at other times of the day. And this had any number of ramifications, not the least being that people fell into ditches, off of wharves, off of bridges, lost their lives, broke their limbs from treading home at night in the darkness. One expression for being drunk was, he sees two moons. So too, of course, did intoxication make large numbers of males in particular, who frequented alehouses, all the more belligerent. An extraordinarily high percentage of brawls either took place within alehouses late at night or afterwards once one had left the premises.
Yeah, that still happens today.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Then there was the sorry tale of one Englishman who could not find his way home and passed out and fell asleep in a street gutter and was shot because another pedestrian thought that he was a rabid dog from his snoring.
At this time in pre-industrial households, people would get up in the middle of the night. This was very interesting. What did they do while they were up?
Anything and everything. Some would only rise to use a nearby chamber pot. Others might check on an ill member of the family or stir the fire in the hearth. Still others would leave the house to smoke tobacco, if not inside, then out, or even visit a near neighbor. Some would pilfer apples from an adjoining orchard. This was the fabled dead of night from roughly midnight until 3 a.m. That was, according to popular lore, the most dangerous period for both crime and evil spirits. Definitely, there was a significant portion of crime that took place during this period, oftentimes by individuals who, yes, would go to bed at, say, 9 p.m., sleep their first sleep, as the term was popularly known, and then, as you correctly say, rise at midnight or sometime shortly thereafter. And then there were still others who would remain in bed, meditate for up to an hour or more, reflect on the day past or the prospects ahead. Large numbers would reflect upon dreams that typically they would have awakened from. Mm. This has been documented not just by literary sources of that age, but also in clinical experiments at the National Institute of Mental Health. A very prominent sleep authority by the name of Tom Weir conducted experiments whereby he, over a period of weeks, put some 15 young men in rooms without the benefit at night of artificial light. He was interested in trying to determine what prehistoric sleep patterns might have been. And sure enough, the pattern that eventually developed, whereby they slept a first sleep, awakened for an hour or more, and then went back to bed, that pattern was virtually the same as I discovered in historical records. He also discovered that, sure enough, before they awakened from their first sleep, they typically were in the midst of a very vivid dream, thereby suggesting, and my evidence suggests this as well, that this conduit or avenue to one's dream life may now have been lost, given the compressed, consolidated sleep that we experience today. Typically, we arise in the morning, and whatever we've been dreaming about very quickly escapes, it disappears. We no longer give it much thought. People took their dreams in the early modern era extremely seriously, and I think one explanation for that lies in the fact that in the dead of night, they frequently were awakened to reflect upon their dreams at some length and internalize those visions.
Yeah. We've got one caller waiting to talk with us. And before we run out of time, we just have a minute, maybe two, here at the close of this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Let's make sure we get this listener included here this afternoon. Line one, listener in Urbana. Hi.
Yeah, to bring up a touchy subject, which I was reminded of in this French film, whose name I forget, but about this magical girl who could hear everyone over the city having sex. I was just curious, did they use euphemisms for the sounds of people having sex, or there must have been a whole thing about that we've kind of lost, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Not really. If you read legal depositions, for example, that were filed in cases of adultery, euphemisms were not widely employed. The terminology could be at times extremely vivid, so vivid that I hesitate to repeat any of them on the air.
Yeah, don't get us into trouble here this afternoon.
Pardon me?
I said don't get us into trouble with the FCC this afternoon.
No.
Yeah. We got you loud and clear, I think.
If I could just add one thing, though.
Sure.
I forgot to mention that during this interval of wakefulness between first and second sleep, it was also a time that medical authorities widely endorsed as the proper time for sexual relations between husbands and wives. There was one French physician in the 16th century, for example, who wrote in a essay concluding that early morning intercourse enabled plowmen, artisans, other laborers to beget numerous children with their wives, simply because when they first went to bed, they were so exhausted that they had little interest, nor did their wives. But as he then put it, after their first sleep, and that's the term he uses, intercourse was conducted, and here I'm quoting verbatim, when they have more enjoyment, and as he put it, do it better. and I think he does have a point, all joking aside, that significantly, I think, for our understanding of early modern demography and population, segmented sleep probably did enhance a couple's ability to conceive children, since fertility ordinarily benefits from rest.
Huh. Another reason not to be abroad at night. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We have to wrap up here because we've used up the time. Roger, thank you again very much.
Well, thank you.
Roger Ekirch, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His book, At Day's Close, Night in Times Past, published by W.W. Norton. Let's find out now what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Oh, I love those kinds of interviews. It reminded me that some of the terms that we use on the air are pretty fun here, too, as well, like covering your shorts, which happened, I believe, in the bean pit just a bit this afternoon as futures went higher and people decided to even up before they got into those USDA WASDE numbers, the World Agricultural and Supply Demand Estimates that are due out tomorrow morning from NASS at 7:30 a.m. We'll take a complete look at them during our pre-opening market report, which comes to you at 8:50 tomorrow morning right here on WILL AM 580. Now let's take a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade as they close this afternoon on a Thursday. July futures in the wheat pit, 317 the high, the low at 312.5, a settlement price there at 314.25. They were up one. September's 327, the high, the low at 322.25, settled at 324.5, up a quarter cent for the day. December futures 339, the high, the low at 333.75. Settlement price for the December wheat at $3.35.75. They were a penny and a quarter higher for the day. The March contract for next year up 2 cents. 349, the high, the low at 344, settlement price at 347.5. May futures now, 352, the high, the low at 351, settled on that low, up 2 for the day. From the corn pit, nearby July futures, 216.75, the high, the low at $2.13, settled 215.5. They were down a half on the day, as was most of the rest of the pit. September futures, 225.75, the high, the low at 222.25, and September corn, $2.25, the settlement price down one half. December contract now, 235.5 the high, low at 231.25, settled 234.5. They were off a quarter, and the March contract down a full penny today. Rather, the March contract down a half today at 243.5 on the high, the low at 239.75, and that half lower for the March contract at $2.42.5. May futures were the ones that were down a full penny, 247.5 the high, the low at 244.5. May next year, $2.46.25, were off one for the day. And next year's July corn contract for 2006, $2.52 the high, the low at 248.5, and a settlement price at $2.51 for the July corn next year. They were off one half for the day. July oats now, 145 the high, the low at 141, settled 142.75, a penny and a half lower. September futures down 1.5, a high today of 149, a low at 146, and a settlement for those Septembers down a penny and a half at $1.47 and one half. From the soy complex, beans managed to rally just a bit in the face of tomorrow's USDA reports this afternoon. Up 5¾ cents off some seasonal lows, 675.5, the high, the low at 659.5, settlement price at 673.25. Once again, that July bean contract up 5¾ today. August futures, 678, the high, the low at 663, settled 676.25, 6.5 cents higher. And the September futures, 682, the high, the low at $6.65, settled 677.75, they were up 5.5 cents. November contract, your new crop harvest month, $6.86, the high, the low at 669. November beans settled $6.84¼, up 6¼ for the day. And the January futures, 687, the high, the low at 670, settled 684¼, 6.5 cents higher. And finally for the day, the March contract at 679.5 in the bean pit for the high, the low at 665, settled 678, rounding out the contracts there, 6¼ higher for the day for the March soybeans. Bean meal futures now, 213.50 the high, the low at $209.10, settled 212.90. They were $1.80 higher. The bean meal August contract up $2 even, 214 the high, the low at 209.30, and a settlement price at 213.40. Once again, that August bean meal contract up $2 even. July bean oil, 23.25, the high, the low at 22.62, settlement price at 23.13. They were 15 higher in the August oil, up 16, 23.20 for the settlement, with a high of 23.32 and a low at 22.75. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Lower day today for livestock prices. August feeder cattle, the high 112.77.5, the low 111.10, the settlement 111.20, that down 160. September 111.40, the high 109.70, the low 110.10, the settlement, that down 157.5. October 110.10, the high 108.30, the low 108.62.5, the settlement, that down 167.5. June live cattle 84.60, the high 83.60, the low 83.62.5, the settlement, that down 97.5. August 83.40, the high 82.02.5, the low, the settlement 82.12.5, that down 110. June lean hogs up a nickel today, 67.50, the high, the low 66.90, the settlement 67.17.5, that up 5. July 69.75, the high 68.80, the low 68.85, the settlement, that down 20. August 68.47.5, the high 67.55, the low 68.02.5, the settlement, that down 15. October 59.55, the high, the low 58.90. The settlement 59.17.5, down 25. July bellies 72.52.5, the high 69.20, the low 70.60, the settlement at down 112.5. And the Dow up 19 points at 10,496. The NASDAQ up 12 at 2072. The S&P up 5 at 1199.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful.